Agenda item number 8, Mr. Greg Ray.
Morning, Jim. Now we're going to turn our attention to the Northern Neck. Mr. Greg Ray is requesting authorization to install 4 80-foot-long hex box breakwaters with beach nourishment aligned 75 feet channelward to mean low water adjacent to his property situated along the Great Wicomico River in Northumberland County. This is a... Could you take the lights down a little bit? There's a bit of a glare there. But, well, probably from my head. Anyway, any point down here in this location by the discreet little red arrow I've got over there. And where we are, the Potomac River is off to the right here. I'm sorry, the bay is off to the right here. The Potomac River is up to the north. And this is an aerial photograph. Mr. Ray owns this point right here. The project's going in right along here. I think we can have the lights up now. Thank you. Thank you. The project is located approximately 3/4 mile north of Sandy Point, which is off in this direction. And these are going to be constructed with a unit called a hex box. And these hex boxes are precast units, and there's going to be 10 of these precast units per breakwater. There's going to be 4 of these breakwaters. And the breakwaters are going to, and I've got some drawings in a moment, but the breakwaters are going to be centered around and move right in this area right near the house. This is Mr. Ray's house right here. In addition, there is going to be a proposal to place 2,500 cubic yards of sand between the breakwater units and the beach. This is what is currently proposed. There's the house I just noted. There's a pretty steep bluff here, but it drops down. And here are the individual breakwaters offshore. Each of these breakwaters, this is the first, the southern two of the 4 breakwaters, 80 feet long, and they are these precast hex box concrete boxes. Behind it, there's going to be some fill. That is sand. Initially, Mr. Ray's agent, Cement Solutions, represented here today by Mr. Warren Veazey, their creator of the hex box system, proposed placing 7 breakwaters in a deeper water, 130 feet offshore. You can see these are only 75. And then spacing them a little bit further apart, at 100 feet apart. That proposal did not include any beach nourishment. As the project evolved, VIMS and the Office of Research and Advisory Services commented 4 separate times, each time there was a change in the project. They suggested some design changes, which included relocating the structures closer to the shore, which you might see here, and adjustment of the spacing between the breakwaters a little bit closer. The reports consistently highlighted the need for the beach nourishment, which was later added, and suggested the use of Class 2 and Class 3 riprap on all the structures in lieu of the precast concrete structures. They also noted the placement of a stand of submerged aquatic vegetation. I have a map that I'll show you in a moment in the project area, and recommended that at least the 2 southernmost, the ones I'm showing here, breakwaters be constructed of stone, of the Class 2 and 3 riprap, as opposed to the precast units. In the most recent comments, the original proposed an iteration in the middle of the process proposed putting approximately 13 1,333 cubic yards of sand. VIMS didn't think that was quite enough, so they upped the number to 2,500. And here's what this is the second set that's further north, pretty much the same concept, same distance, same spacing. Hit the house now, slides down the picture. So these are the ones that are furthest to the north. VIMS believes that the current alignment of the structures relieves a great deal of the SAV issue. However, they have some points they want to make about the southern. They still would like to see those made out of stone. But here's a profile. It shows the hex boxes. You'll see that they're 75 feet from the mean high water, a little bit closer from mean low water. Here's a little bit closer detail. These are precast. These are floated. These are floated into place and scuttled right down. And the ports that you see here, these ports are the holes are ported. You know, they're filled, brought into place, knock them out, down it goes. They put sand in it. That's one of the advantages of this particular system is, as Mr. Vies will point out, is its ability to access areas where the depth might be an issue, and also the fact that they're considerably less expensive than a traditional breakwater system. Here's the view of the shoreline. I am a little bit south of the house. I'm looking down at the actual Haney Point. There's the beach, and then I turn around and look in the opposite direction. This is where the alignment of the structures are going to go. Nice beach. Now, what I probably have shown a little bit better is if you were to look a little bit to the left of this photograph, it does jump up quite a bit. I'd say that bluff 50. Yeah, it's a high one. But then it slopes down, so there is equipment access there. But he does have this erosion problem. Trees are falling in the water. You can see some of the tree litter along the shoreline. This is the SAV that I was mentioning earlier. Let me get this is Haney Point right here. And then let me go back to this nice photograph here, aerial photograph. The Department of Environmental Quality has stated that the water protection permit will not be required. And I'd like to move into the summary and recommendation. While this design has been before us before, staff remains concerned with the deployment of a modular concrete breakwater structures in lieu of riprap breakwaters, especially in locations exposed to significant wave climate. The applicant has, however, incorporated several modifications to minimize the impacts on existing aquatic resources. That is, he brought it closer, put them closer together. He also put more sand behind it. The idea being that the backfilling and creating a tombola behind the breakwater allows the waves to break over the hex boxes and run up and lose energy as they accelerate up the beach, so that you would increase the ability of the efficacy of the structure to act as an erosion buffer. So they have minimized some of the impacts. However, one of the things that, and I'm paraphrasing here, you can read the report in its entirety, of course. What staff is proposing is that the south two structures, the two breakwaters at the end, be faced with riprap, as opposed to being entirely constructed of riprap. Just have the front end, the leading edge of the structures, have them faced with stone. Because the idea is there's a concern that VIMS still maintains that the waves reflecting off of those structures would impact the nearby SAV. Now, Mr. Vesey has some data that he'll bring to the front that suggests the waste study that suggests that his structures will not do that. And I'll let Mr. Veazey handle that. He had a study conducted by the University of Delaware where that might bring another facet of the discussion to the front for your consideration. So what we would propose here at this juncture is a couple of things. First of all, as I mentioned a moment ago, propose to leave them deploy them as proposed, but face them with a veneer of riprap. Also, another thing that we did a few years ago is we worked out with the Virginia Institute of Marine Science and with the Engineering and Surveying Department a series of special conditions directed toward monitoring and getting a handle on how affected these structures are, a monitoring protocol, and that's what you see before you. I'd like to talk about that a little bit. The first thing is that I'll just read quickly here. The applicant should agree to complete the following monitoring requirements for the authorized breakwaters to determine whether the structures are effective at preventing further erosion of the shoreline, holding sand in place, and building up additional sand for erosion control, and whether the structures themselves are stable. The monitoring shall include the following. And these are based on standard surveying practices. A fixed baseline approximately parallel to the shoreline established on the upland and is located that is reasonably expected to remain during the monitoring period. That's 5 years. And that is referenced to other fixed points so that it can be reproduced if necessary. The baseline shall have horizontal and vertical controls. The horizontals may be local. The vertical controls shall be based upon mean low water. The baseline shall be marked by permanently driven steel pipes, rods, concrete monuments on the upland. At a minimum, permanent markers shall be placed at any angle on the baseline. An array of fixed transects shall be established perpendicular to the baseline so that they begin a minimum of 20 feet upstream of the structures and end a minimum of 25 feet downstream of the structures. The transects shall be positioned so that they are located one at each end of the 80-foot hex box breakwater, and the transect shall extend from the baseline and extend 50 feet channelward of the breakwater structures. A grid. Elevation shall be taken along each transect at a horizontal spacing sufficient to document any changes in slope greater than 10 degrees or no more than 10 feet apart starting from the baseline. In addition, all survey data shall comply a height of plus or minus 0.2 feet vertically, plus or minus, horizontally, plus or minus 0.2 feet vertically, plus or minus 0.1 foot. At all the protocols for each survey shall meet the minimum standards for topographic surveys performed performed in Virginia. And the number five, a minimum of 3 geographically fixed location survey points on the upper surface of each breakwater shall be established to assess shifting, rotation, and differential settling of the structures or its components. The locations of these points must be documented in three-dimensional spaces relative to the baseline and vertical datum at each annual survey. Photos shall be taken. The permittee agrees to supply the data for analysis that will continue for a minimum of 5 years and will be conducted at the following intervals. Prior to construction, upon construction completion, once a year for 5 years during the same season, after the first storm event with greater than 25 knots sustained winds or surges of greater than 4.5 feet, mean low water. The permittee agrees all monitoring surveys shall be submitted within 30 days following each survey interval, and the permittee agrees that all surveying must be conducted under the direct control and personal supervision of a licensed surveyor or a professional engineer applicable with the appropriate code endorsement. This is the final one that I have. The permittee agrees that should the performance of the structure fail and result in unforeseen adverse effects on the uses of the state waters and bottomlands, marine fisheries, tidal wetlands, adjacent or nearby properties, water quality, or submerged aquatic vegetation, that the permittee shall remove the structures within 90 days of receiving notification from the commission. And finally, we recommend the assessment of the appropriate royalty for the placement of the sand nourishment channel where to mean low water. And that completes what I have. And Mr. Veazey is here as well as the applicant.
Other questions from the commission? Mr. Tackard.
This two questions. Sand, which way is the sand flowing in this on this little peninsula
well,
here?
The sand supply, as Vince pointed out, there's a lot of sand movement here. And that's one of the reasons why throughout the evolution of this process, the original supposition was that there was going to be a lot of sand pouring into the system. That doesn't appear to be likely. And Vims, of course, can be more specific on that. But the idea is that it probably sessions back and forth, and there might actually be movement coming down. If you see here, there is movement of sand in this direction, coming out in this direction.
Sure.
You see that spit rolling around that way? But there really isn't much, sir.
Mm-hmm. And then my second follow-up question would be, you indicated there was some erosion, but the pictures didn't show us an excessive amount.
SAB?
Erosion. Excuse me.
Oh well, the erosion is that appears that the beaches is there is a little bit of the beach is getting narrower, and there's quite a bit of there's a scarp up along the and it there is erosion at the base of the bank, but Mr. Ray has lived there his entire life. I suspect Mr. Ray could give you a lot of information about what's been happening along that shoreline, in as much as he's not had it all his life.
Thank you.
Mr. Erskine.
Mr. Madden, I had a question, I guess, about the placement of or the proposed placement of these hex boxes. It's 75 feet channelward, so it's a riparian area. This doesn't impinge on public or private oyster ground?
No, sir.
Okay.
I'm glad you pointed that out. When it was real large, when it was a big, huge project, the oyster ground leaseholder did have some concerns, but that's been resolved.
I could understand.
His oyster lease is closer to the mouth of Ways Creek. Yeah, he jumped in, but once it was scaled down, those were resolved. And Mr. Ray can speak about that if you have some questions concerning what nature of the negotiation was with the oyster ground leaseholder.
Sure. Thank you.
Other questions from the commission? I have a question.
Yes, sir.
What's the fetch at this particular location?
Oh, I would say, you're looking right at the mouth of the bay. The mouth of the bay, the bay mouth, 2,500 yards, 3,000. What would you think, Warren?
What's your number?
Well, from the northwest.
Yeah.
That fetch is probably like 2 miles, where you see the turning point, and from the southeast, it is literally all the way through.
All the way to the eastern shore. Yeah.
It is inside the river mouth. However.
Well, hold on a second.
Yeah, it is fetch to the horizon, sir.
Why don't we bring you forward here at this point? Unless there's other questions to staff. Let me swear you in.
Sure.
Do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Gregory Ray.
Mr. Ray.
Good morning.
On the record here, this is audio taped. Would you explain the fetch from your perspective?
Yes. So to the southeast, which is essentially the opposite of the direction of the arrow,
mm-hmm.
you see on the chart in front of you, it is looking directly out into Ingram Bay, into the mouth of the bay. You have a clear view of, actually, I can see the Onancock light from my house, and I can see the Wicomico light, or what was the location of the Wicomico light, all the way out to the eastern shore. So you have a horizon view from that perspective. To the northwest, which is up the river, it's to the number 9 buoy, the turn buoy that's up there. It's about 2.5 to 3 miles, I guess. And we take quite a beating there. To the south is Sandy Point, if you're familiar with that, on the Great Wicomico River,
yep.
Which at one time extended itself almost all the way out to its buoy location, and it has since eroded, which has left us wide open to that fetch. And if you look at this particular drawing, I'll use the mouse here, you see when we talk about the erosion that you asked about, Mr. Tankard, you see an area this is probably 1950s, I would imagine. This topo that we're looking at here looks like mine that I have hanging on the wall. And these areas right here that you see, they are gone. I suppose that we've lost 3 to 4 acres of property in my lifetime since teenager years, what's thereabouts. Let me see if I can get back up to the picture that you had. Sorry about that. Which one are you using? Sorry.
That one?
That one. And so you can see in this picture that there is no vegetation here that you were seeing in that, in this big lump that stuck out here to the side. That is actually, that amount of erosion is feeding this point. If I stopped it, we would lose the point. And I suspect that as I come and start to put in and fill in with Tom Bolos here, that I will start to see this point erode. Okay? I do. You're taken from one place for another, and I believe that is going to be the way this will work. I own this whole piece of property all the way out to actually above the drawing line here, and I have put riprap in from here to here in this section, but intend to actually try to stabilize this entire shoreline. This piece of property is going into a conservation easement, hopefully this year, with Northern Neck Land Conservation. And one of the things that I am trying to accomplish somewhere along that way is to stabilize this whole piece of property as well. The original plan is for living shorelines down this side with the northwest, and this, because of the amount of open water flow that we have to it, has to be something different than that. The original plan was actually to go offshore, like we said, at 160 feet, because in the past, in my childhood, this was all SAV, all the way to the shoreline with eelgrass. I have tried over the last 25 years of planting eelgrass in that area. I get it established, we get a storm, we lose it all. So the original plan for not putting in beach nourishment and going offshore was actually to create a calm area behind it to reestablish the SAVs that cannot get reestablished anymore because the fetch has changed when Sandy Point went away. That was the original plan. I understand Vim's perspective on it, and that's why we have decided to move inland. Where that 75 foot in the drawing shows is actually kind of along what you see this beach right here, and the water shallows up significantly, and actually that area is out of the water in a very, very low winter tide. You really shouldn't have an issue from anything channel where I own, or I lease, sorry, the oyster ground in this vicinity, and Forrest Ameren leases in this vicinity. And Forrest and I agreed, certainly once they moved, that he would not have any problem with that. And so that's also the second reason that I ended up moving shoreward for those items. A couple things. I did talk to Jim Gunn about doing this project at one time. That cost for this southeastern shoreline was about $600,000 to $700,000, depending on whether I sculpted the shoreline with it or just installed the structures. And that is one of the reasons why I went looking for a different method to get these in there, knowing that I have a couple of thousand feet of shoreline to do before I finish my projects here over time. I'm looking for a cheaper solution. That's one of the reasons why we've chosen hedge boxes. And I am not in agreement with armoring these, which I would call the two western faces of the hex boxes that we're putting in. As far as the monitoring program, I'm fine with the monitoring program. What I would not prefer is a performance bond, because what I would expect to see is actually some erosion to actually happen from that. I'm going to be saving property in front of my house at the expense of the point. That's my belief for 50-some years of living on that piece of property. There's just no way that you can continue. When you see the types of storms, things like Isabel, just the hard northwest that we get in the wintertime, there's no way that that piece of property can maintain itself without having some sort of nourishment coming to it. And that nourishment has been coming from the erosion elsewhere on that property. So I'm trading somewhere, and, you know, there are new trees down. There are pictures in front of the house. I have trees that are in my yard that are now down from this winter storm laying on the beach. So let's continue on that basis.
Questions from the commission? You had mentioned a performance bond?
The performance bond is in the last piece that Jeff mentioned, which is the monitoring, the last section of the piece that they have provided has asked for a performance bond to remove it within 90 days, that sort of thing. From a shoreline erosion control, it's going to be very difficult because I think when we put these things in, we're going to stop the erosion behind the walls. I'm relatively certain that I will see some change in the point afterwards, and so the question is, what does the performance bond mean? Because it's, we understand that there's a trade there on how this piece of property is going to react to stopping sand flow down the shoreline on those southeast winds that are feeding that stuff.
Other questions from the commission? Thank you, sir.
Sure.
Still public hearing. Somebody else in the audience wish to testify in favor of this project? Please come forward. Ms. Ryan, do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Please state your name for the record.
Warren Veazey, Vice President of Cement Shoreline Systems.
Welcome.
For the project. So I have two concerns and answering VIMS's concerns. The one would be the facing of the two lower breakwaters, as they believe that the wave reflection of their rubble mound or riprap breakwater would be lower than a vertical hex box breakwater. And their comments, they call out, a good and common source of technical information can be found in MIDI guidance documents published by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. It is not necessary to review this literature as it is common accepted marine engineering concepts. So to counter that, I would like to read from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers SEM manual, dated 2006. Chapter 2 mentions a perforated front wall breakwater, i.e. the front wall is perforated by holes or slots where the wave chamber behind dissipates the wave energy and reduces both forces on the caisson and wave reflection. Chapter 7 of the same book mentions a range of wave reflection of 1 for a perfect vertical face, 0.9 for a varied vertical face, which would be achieved by our sawtooth design, and then 0.6 for a rubble breakwater, and approaching 0 with a gentle sloping beach, which is what we all, you know, striving for. But one of the references called in that chapter calls out a paper in the International Conference of Coastal Engineering by Dr. Aislop, and I believe it's Tarati, it's a Japanese fellow, I believe, back in 1988. This is actually something that I pulled from when I designed my hex boxes, Reflections of Coastal Structures. Paper shows that the effect of a screen porosity, the holes in the vertical walls, finds coefficients of reflection as low as 0.2 to 0.1 with a porosity ratio of 0.2 between the number of holes and the gap of the in the chamber, in the box, basically. So I have specifically designed this hex box for the wave periods of the Potomac River and this the Chesapeake Bay for that. And I also then took my hex box design, built a scale model, took it out to the wave tank, since VIMS does not have a wave tank, took it out to the University of Maryland's Center for Environmental Science out in Horn Point Laboratory, and ran in their wave tank with my just a rectangular box, not the hex shape, and confirmed that I got, you know, down to 0.4, the wave reflection. So that, in my mind, is calling the question why VIMS is asking for stone anywhere, or B, facing the stone to lower wave reflection, when I believe the hex box design by engineering is lower than their rubble breakwater. They've never provided me with what numbers they were basing on. They never asked me for mine. What was my wave reflection? So I'm calling the question, how did they come up with their guidance to you when they didn't ask me what my reflection was, and they never provided what a rubble one was? So I leave that to you to make your decision. And then the hex box itself. My company, my father, Dr. Veazey, started this back in 96 because we have property on the Potomac River with 12-mile fetches and a 40-foot-high eroding cliff with his house, you know, properly located 150 feet back from the edge of that cliff. But, you know, you wake up after a storm and suddenly you're 120 feet away from that. You know, you have giant oak trees falling over. So he, just looking around for a solution, and being Mr. Fix-It, wanted to do it himself, started out with highway safety barriers and figured out through testing that they weren't tall enough and they weren't, didn't have a stable bottom. So he came up with his own design, patented at the L-wall, which is basically an L shape with the back L facing into the bank, so that when there's dirt on top of that L, they can't tip forward. How most, you know, bulkheads fail, they, you know, the tiebacks break and they lean out. The other thing is he realized, you know, letting water flow through it, so again you don't have that water pressure building up. So over the years we patented that. We've been installing them since '96. We have over a mile of them. They all survived, went through Hurricane, you know, Ernesto and Isabel. We had one 8-foot section fail on the corner of our wall where the neighboring riprap completely blew out and lost 30 feet, and we got in run around. So that's the one replacement we've had to do, 8 feet and over a mile of installations for 20 years now. Pretty good record, I would say, where we've had neighboring wooden walls and riprap replaced, you know, 2-3 times. In that. So moving on, then obviously nobody likes vertical bulkheads. So when I came into the picture, as a marine engineer from Merchant Marine Academy and sailed for 10 years and came back and now work for the Navy up in Dahlgren by our house in King George, trying to come up with breakwaters to improve on the pile of rock, which, you know, you have a 6-foot-high breakwater, you're covering 25 feet of the bottom to create your pyramid. That's a very big impact, 5 or 6 tons of stone to get that height. Very expensive, and not always, you know, you can't always get it in a position because of the river, you know, the bottom depth, stopping a barge from getting in or from working from the shore. So we started out just with septic tank boxes, concrete boxes. Have some of those in front of my house put in '98. They filled up with sand. We have SAV growing in them. We have a tombolo behind them. They're very nice, but they're 2.5 feet tall, so limited usability, and they're rectangular. Again, VMRC at that point, I think Mr. Madden actually, when he was in charge of that county area, came out and said, great idea, work on the wave reflection, because that's our one concern, creating scour in the front. So we looked around. We had one project on the mouth of the Potomac with a 25-mile fetch, where we asked a concrete plant to design us a rectangular box. It was before I had found all these studies. And they came up with a, you know, 2-inch thick wall. We put it out in place. Some of those started failing. So that's why I went back to the drawing board to come up with my own design, found all these papers online, found how to lower the wave reflection, not only with the sawtooth face, but also with the holes in it to cancel out the wave reflection. Came up with the hex box design, which I can vary from 6 feet to 4 feet. Started putting them in 2006.
Mr. Vesey, can I interrupt here? Let's deal with this actual project. Hearing you, I'm not sure if you're in favor of this or against this.
Okay. Well, this points to the new structure idea, requiring a 5-year study. So the hex box was first installed in 2006. I've installed over 8 locations in that time, 250 boxes, have done a 3-year monitoring project for VIMS and delivered it to them, showing how sand built up. No problems with dislocation and moving of the boxes or failure or anything. That was 2008 to 2011. Like I mentioned, I've done 8 installations. You can go on Google Earth and pull them up and see they're all in place, all in a straight line, all with, you know, not all with sand building up, one position. There was no sand there, but it was a 60-foot-high cliff. There was no other way to add sand.
Again, let's go back to this actual application with this actual design.
Fine with their – I suggest that you approve the permit without the stone added to the face. As I've shown and as I've provided, I believe my wave reflection coefficient is lower to answer their issue of SAV being damaged by wave reflection. And for the monitoring program, I put to you that I've done it before. This is not a new project. We've got 8 installations. They're all working. They're there. They haven't moved. So I don't see a reason to have yet another monitoring program.
Any questions from the commission? Thank you, Mr. Reese.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify in favor of this project? Anybody in the audience wishes to testify in opposition to this project? Mr. Madden.
I wanted to add, expand on what Mr. Tankard said about the erosion rate. If in April 21, 2015, BIMS commented the following. The erosion rate of the eastern side of Haney Point over the past 50 years was less than 0.5 feet per year. Most of the erosion appears to have occurred during or since early 2000s, likely due to the series of recent extratropical storms, indicating that the shoreline erosion is generally event-driven at this location. The composition of the upland bank is primarily clay, with fine sand being a minor constituent, and sand movement in the near shore is minimal. Therefore, we do not expect the proposed design to accumulate sufficient quantities, hence the need for sand. And that's all I have.
Thank you.
Any other questions to staff? Mr. Erskine.
Mr. Madden, I have a question. Essentially, I see this as, aside from, you know, the wave coefficients and, you know, the engineering side of it, that these are structures going in the water. And when we examine aquaculture structures, for example, going in the water, there's signage or marking and things like that. I understand it's near shore, 75 feet from mean low water. What kind of markings would accompany something like this? Because clearly it's a hazard.
Well, I would say it might be appropriate. However, the depth, it's quite shallow here. The people who probably run aground on this would be someone on a jet ski. You can wade out there most of the distance out there, sir. But if you think that signage is appropriate, I think this is obviously the proper venue to discuss such a matter, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
May I
offer a comment on that? Mr. Ray, I'll tell you what. Let's get the commission to ask a few questions, and then I'll get you to wrap this up here. Are there other questions from the commission?
Mr. Tankard. So are these structures the same that were used on the point that sticks out into the bay from Cherrystone Creek, Dan Hoffler's property? Is that the same structure? Just
that
so I understand what method. We're looking
all
at.
Right.
I know what riprap is. It's pretty. But these structures are new to me.
The design that was used at Point Farm, I don't know where it came from, but it was a design that was brought to the concrete plant, and they created them on the shore. Okay. I don't know if it was a VC design or not.
They are similar, though. No question.
Mr. Madden, I had a question about permit condition number 5.
Stand by.
As it's worded now, and let's read it into the record here. Permittee agrees that should the performance of the structure fail and result in unforeseen adverse effects on other state uses of state water bottoms, state waters and water bottoms, marine fisheries, tidal wetlands, adjacent property owners, water quality, etc., the permittee shall remove the structures within 90 days of receiving notification from the commission. So, you're saying with this permit condition that if it fails, that's fine. No harm, no foul. But if it fails and has an environmental impact on the fisheries, then it has to be removed.
I will let Mr. Watkins flesh that one out, put some corners on that if you'd like.
Because I guess I got to tell you, my concern is here is that, I mean, this is an fairly new technology and a unique environment with this particular location. If this fails, it's going to be a mess. And I would rather not have staff or the commission in a point arguing over not whether it failed, but whether there was adverse impacts.
Good point, sir.
Do you see my point, Mr. Watkinson?
I think I do. I think, you know, with a lot of structures that are traditional as well as innovative or new, sometimes they don't always work. And either they don't protect the property and there's no harm, no foul, there's no adverse effect, But what we're concerned about here is if they do fail and the boxes scatter, for example, by large storms and they're all over the place and they affect navigation and they're on SAV or they result in some type of unforeseen erosion problem somewhere else, then that's the type of issue where we would think they need to come back and recommend they be removed. If they're out there and they're just not real effective, but they haven't had any adverse effect, I don't know that we would require that they be removed.
Well, in which case, then, to my way of thinking, that the structures wouldn't have failed.
Right. It's just a matter of whether they're protecting the property from erosion.
Right. It's one thing that they're not effective. It's another thing if they fail, at least in my mind.
Yes, I agree.
Would there be an issue? Would staff have a concern with amending condition number 5 to make it simpler? Should the structure fail, they're removed within the 90 days of a commission order.
That'd be fine.
And I'm throwing that out for the commission, a suggestion for the commission to consider.
Yes, I think that.
In the meantime, while you're all pondering that, I'd like to hear from Mr. Ray here to get his input here on the discussion so far and where he would like to see things go. It is, after all, his project.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Quickly to add to the question on the navigation, before I go back to that, there is a new Virginia public oyster reef installed with signage with 4 poles. In this vicinity, the only traffic that's coming out of Ways Creek comes around our point. The channel is westward, and so this area has now been, with 4 different signs, has been sort of said, beware, do not come into this area. Of course, these are far inshore of that as well. From my point of view, no navigation. There is an occasional jet ski. Okay. The second point on condition number 5, it's the clarity problem that I have an issue with, because again, if it's erosion control, it may work and directly behind the walls as we put it, and we may get erosion on our point further down. I'm expecting to pay attention to that myself. So the real issue for me is not whether you guys could come back and say take the wall out, it's not working correctly. It's at whatever discretion someone decides it to be, because that language isn't very clear to me what performance means in this situation. Because if it's just about erosion control for the property behind it, I'm absolutely 100% in agreement with that piece of it. We pulled the channel shoreward so that we get out of the SAB bottoms and those types of things as well, so that we don't have those issues. And I hope that would have been enough for VIMS to have been satisfied with that. So that's my way of looking at it, because I just don't want the verbiage to be so wide open that for any reason that could be asked to be removed within 90 days at the cost of it. Put it in and take it out.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Ray. Is there anybody else in the audience who has not testified that wishes to testify on this matter, either pro or con? Seeing none, the public hearing is closed. The matter is before the commission for discussion and action. Mr. Ballard.
I wonder if we could hear from VIMS in response to the correlation coefficients and how they feel about the facing of stone on the hex boxes.
Certainly. Lyle Varnell at VIMS. You sure you want to get into some math here, Mr. Ballard?
Keep it high level.
be glad to. I guess I could answer a lot here and say a lot, but I like to try to keep it specific. We have reviewed the study by Mr. Veazey. Let me just say that 2 things. One is we would probably have designed it differently, and we don't necessarily interpret the results the same as Mr. Veazey. Second part is the core, many core studies on wave diffusion. He is correct. I mean, but there are many designs for perforation, and much of the core studies were done in harbors for large boat traffic or small boat traffic, not specific to this. We've given a reference in our first letter that's one of the more accepted and widely used core studies on breakwaters in shallow water for this. And actually, my brother-in-law is one of the authors on that, full disclosure. So we do. Stone breakwaters were also monitored when they first started going in. They're used all over the estuary now in Maryland and Virginia, dozens of places, and we've seen how they work. And, you know, I do agree with Mr. Veazey, the perforations do help, and the design of the box other than a square does help. It doesn't get to the level of a stone breakwater. The stone does diffuse and diffract wave energy much better than a vertical. And the design of his box that we've discussed at VIMS, the perforations have to be at the perfect water level for that to work. I won't say the perfect water level, but a water level that can work, and that many times it's not. And especially because of the shoreline, which is a complex shoreline. It's very complex. And it is storm-driven. The 50-year thing, that's the long-range erosion rate here. So with larger storm waves that Mr. Ray would get here, that's the concern for the thing. I mean, you can put any structure in the water that's heavier than the wave energy that you plan to design it for, and it will work in some fashion. So these new structures, that's why we recommended they not be essentially, you know, denied or not even considered, but just monitored, because it's the wave climate in the bay is very varied, and it's a situational process where something designed for one section may work because of the wave climate and the bathymetry and the shoreline situation, and it may not in another place. So that's why we're very cautious with new designs for this. So hopefully I answered some of your questions. I went a little bit farther, I guess, to try to answer some that I'd heard before.
Mr. Pellick.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with the project, but we do have a couple of similar devices on the eastern shore, and I don't believe they were required to have the facing of the stone. Are you familiar with any of those projects that Mr. Tankard referenced?
Well, our shoreline studies program monitors pretty much all the shorelines in the bay and all the structures, you know, over a certain time period. That's a big ask. But it's done not yearly to a very accurate degree, but over a few years it is. And yes, we are familiar with those. Like I say, the amount of sand in the system is a big part of the feasible work. Mr. Ray is correct. I mean, the curling of the spit is a classic metric of the sand is being starved in that area. So he is correct that there's not as much sand as there used to be in the system. So that's why we had thought that, you know, we should at least inform the applicant that more sand, we consider, based on our studies of breakwaters, that more sand would be necessary here, especially since it is an event-driven erosion process in this area, apparently.
Other questions from the commission? Thank you. That is before the commission for discussion and action. Mr. Ballard.
One, I'd like to commend staff on what seems like an exceptionally complex case, working through a lot of details here and really a dynamic area. It seems like we've heard testimony from both sides that's scientific and valid, but at the end of the day, I think I would move to approve staff recommendation with the amendment that the commissioner made for number 5, to strike that language such that it's the performance of the structure fail, and as well as the addition of the appropriate royalties, which was mentioned.
It's motion by Mr. Ballard. Is there a second? Second by Mr. Tankard. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Correct.
Discussion on the motion. Mr. Neal.
Well, I don't know if it's a discussion on the motion. I'm just curious about what
cost increase are we requiring, are we adding by requiring the riprap facing on the two breakwaters?
I don't know. I don't know what the additional cost would for those two sections.
And I have no idea either. I don't know what riprap cost.
Mr. Madden?
Sure.
Can you help?
Just a general idea of the magnitude of the cost increase that we're imposing by just having riprap facings on those two breakwaters.
It's based on the supposition that the riprap would deflect the potential wave energy.
I know why. I'm asking cost.
I don't have a cost. I don't have a cost breakdown of that, sir. No.
Mr. Tankard.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be more expensive. However, I think one of the things we need to think about is that this is something that we have done in the Bay to a limited extent. I think with we testified here today, there was a mile of shoreline that's been done. It's really not very much. So I understand that we're imposing a greater cost, but there's a pretty significant unknown about these structures is what I would respond to you. And further, it seems to me that these structures that I've seen in front of Point Farm, they have moved. They haven't stayed put. I don't know if that's what you've seen, Mr. Ballard.
Any other discussion on the motion? So we have a motion by Mr. Ballard, second by Mr. Tankard. I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any noes? Chair votes aye as well. The motion passes unanimously. Project's approved, gentlemen. Thank you for your input and your time.
Yeah.